So the name of my book is Love's Last Measure, Lessons Found at Death's Door. Sort of right to the point. On the cover is a picture of my husband. He was an artist. And so it's his life that I'm going to be talking about. And I'm just summarizing most of this book because I only have about 20 minutes. So what I am going to spend time on is the actual end of life experience for us. But to begin with, I wanted to title this talk, Taking Tea by the Fire. And some of you may have heard that term, but because I'm right now in the swirl of the precept study, I skipped ahead of our text a little bit and discovered a really exciting precept. I don't know how many times you've heard precepts are exciting, but this one really is. And so in her book, Waking Up to What You Do, Diane Rizzetto is talking about not a precept that we're studying right now, but she's talking about taking up the way of letting go of anger. And this precept is about understanding and embracing the uncomfortable response of anger. So what I just asked you to do was to close your eyes and see what kind of a response you have to the term death and dying. And the reason I thought this precept was exciting is because that understanding can apply to multiple emotions, including our response to death and dying. So here's what Diane has to say about that. What follows in the next few pages of this book is not going to teach you how to wipe anger out of your life. You could substitute death and dying there. What it will offer is some helpful ways for you to wake up to your particular relationship to anger, whether you confront it in yourself or in others. This is the key, to learn how to be awake in the presence of anger instead of swinging into blind action. When, if only for a moment, we can turn our attention to the sensory experience of anger, then we do what Stephen Levine calls taking tea by the fire. To take tea with our outrage or confusion, to meet it eye to eye. We learn about relating to instead of from anger. So the process of death and dying, as we all know, is about letting go. Before we can let go of anything, we have to sit with it and be curious about it. Take tea by the fire with it. And in the case of death and dying, it helps to remember what Andrea talked about last week. Nothing is ever out of place. I was a hospice volunteer for 2 years before I began serious care for my husband, Mike, who after 30 years of living with Parkinson's was approaching the final stage of the disease. I was somewhat prepared for the process of dying, but believe me, walking the end of the path with the person you've been married to for 32 years is an unparalleled experience. Mike was 79 years old when he died. He was an artist of clay and metal, passionate and persevering in adapting his art to his evolving loss of physical and cognitive abilities. In the early stages, we'd been through anger, denial, and depression, and were now on a smoother path. In November of 2011, Mike said, "I know I'm dying. I don't know when, but something is happening inside my body and I have to pay attention now." From that moment, we had 15 months, 2 days, 8 hours, and 55 minutes to immerse ourselves in the process of dying, to have tea by the fire with dying. Every day, every hallucination, every innocent obsession, each holiday, something new arrived by the fire. All the way through to the profound affirmation following Mike's last breath. In April of 2012, we presented Mike's memoir at Village Books. At that time, Mike was between a cane and a walker. After our talk, a man in the front row challenged Mike with this question: "What's Parkinson's done for you?" Mike got himself to the podium and looked at the guy, and he said, "The best thing?" As if there was a long list to choose from. "The best thing is Parkinson's tenderized me." That statement was the start of a higher level of awareness of daily acts of tenderness. Later that year, Mike had a mild stroke. Hallucinations followed. All of his hallucinations were designed to help him let go. His father appeared one night while Mike was washing the dishes. They visited, and his father said, "I like what you've done here, son." Mike was relieved. He had had a contentious, competitive relationship with his father, and he didn't go to his father's funeral in 1998. He regretted that decision. He needed that meeting to happen. At times when I was driving, he'd think I was his mother, and he'd shower me with gratitude. "Thanks, Mom, for all your compassion and love. Thanks for playing catch with me on the ranch when I was little. And thank you for encouraging me to get my master's in ceramics." We entered hospice in November of that year. We sat by the fire and read Oliver Sacks' book, Hallucinations. Sacks identified Mike's hallucinations as complex. They were like little movies. For Mike, there were no taboos, no stigmas. He was proud of his hallucinations. They were his new art, and each one seemed to move him forward on his journey. He floated in and out of mild dementia, and I was puzzled by his frequent statement, "I want to do the right thing for you." It bothered me because he didn't get it. He didn't get that I loved taking care of him. I was tired, yeah, frustrated and scared, but the last thing I would have given up was taking care of him. Anniversaries, especially Valentine's Day, were historically his days. He owned them. And primarily because he didn't have to share with anybody except me. I knew how difficult it was for him to form thoughts and construct letters on paper. So I was desperate to translate all the notes and cards that he gave me. And he usually wrote them and set them by my teacup in the middle of the night when he couldn't sleep, or he taped them to the closet door. They were all written in flat-lined micrographia, if you know what micrographia is. It's teeny tiny, and Parkinson's folks get that a lot, and then it goes down to flat line, but he spent a lot of time writing these notes. So I bought a magnifying glass and translated the script of Parkinson's, and it was really satisfying. After months of notes and efforts to do the right thing, on a cold February morning, Mike had entered the final stage of dying. We had 7 children and 16 grandchildren between us. In the weeks and months before his final stage of living, the house was full of family coming and going, all knowing it was the last time they would see him, and everybody made the most of every moment. On a Sunday night, Mike had his last food and water. He had no pain and was off all medications for the first time in 20 years. He loved it. He slept all the time now and was clearly involved with inner work and active dying. The end felt near. Next morning, our hospice nurse, Grace, arrived for a visit. Mike's son, Randy, was about to leave for his home in New Hampshire. Grace, Randy, and I were standing by the bed when Mike started to pick at his blanket. He could only pick with his right hand because his entire left side was incapacitated from strokes. His eyes were closed as they had been the entire day before. I tried to ignore the blanket picking because I feared drawing unnecessary attention to it, although Grace was well aware of Mike's activity. As we visited, Mike became increasingly restless, a sign that can be due to a lack of oxygen in the blood. Normal activity for this stage. Just as I feared, though, Grace was concerned that his agitation might accelerate. Still standing by the bed, she asked if I would get a syringe of lorazepam from the refrigerator. It's an anti-anxiety treatment. I sighed. I'm trying to keep his system as clean as possible. I reiterated what Grace already knew because I thought it was important. This is the first time in over 20 years he hasn't had to take meds. At the time, I didn't know why I desperately wanted this discussion to go my way. Grace was the expert, I told myself. Then, after a few moments of silence and increased agitation from Mike, she gently suggested an alternative. Would you consider half a dose? That would only be 1 milligram. Oh, I'd rather not, I said with resignation, but I will. Reluctantly, I left the bedside, went to the kitchen, and opened the fridge. Just as I left the just as I picked up a syringe, I heard Grace's order coming from the den. Hold the lorazepam. Mike's awake. He's talking to Randy. I bolted into the den with the syringe still in my hand. As I entered the room, I heard Mike ask, "Where's Anne?" He lifted his head slightly off the pillow as I leaned down to hear him. He had to push the words out with his breath, like he was inflating an air mattress. His tongue beat against the roof of his mouth with every effort of every syllable. "Thank you for everything you're doing and everything you've done," he said. "You're welcome. We're doing a good job, aren't we? And you're doing everything you can to help me, aren't you?" "Yep," he whispered. "You're going to have a good journey, Mike. I will miss you. I will not forget you. Thank you for the good life. I'll love you forever." "I love you too," he said, and his head fell heavily back on the pillow. His eyes were closed again. I bit my lip and tapped nervously on the side rail, trying to slow my heart down. "Oh my God, Grace, did he die?" "No, not yet," she said, still holding the railing on the side of Mike's bed. "But I think he rallied so you wouldn't have to give him the lorazepam." I walked to the end of the bed, wondering if that was even possible. "I guess we'll never know, right?" I said, turning around just in time to see Mike's right hand slowly rising upward toward where Grace was standing. His eyes were closed, his head did not move, but his hand was on its way in slow motion, and his target was right on top of Grace's hand. He squeezed her hand, then dropped his arm back down on the bed. Even though Grace has witnessed years of farewells beside the beds of dying people, at the moment when Mike squeezed her hand, affirming her conclusion that he rallied so I would not have to give him the lorazepam, Grace looked stunned. And that is the reason I've given her the pseudonym with a double meaning of God's favor and thank you. Fortunately, there were two observers who could testify to Mike's act of love that morning. I could never have made this up. If that momentary exertion truly was what they referred to as the rally, he chose a perfect statement for his last surge of energy. Albert Einstein said, "The most beautiful and profound emotion we can experience is the sensation of the mystical. It is the power of all true science." The next day, Mike's daughter, Greta, arrived from Oregon. By then, Mike was unresponsive, but he could still hear. Greta had always wanted what she called a story with her dad. Since she was very young, all she had was summer visits with him, and she wanted more. Wednesday night, I lay on an air mattress next to his hospital bed. I talked to him and read from the booklet that tells us what usually happens to a body when the body is dying. I hoped he could continue on his path with no pain and no fear. Only 2 days ago, Mike was lucid when he halted the lorazepam and agreed that we were doing a good job. Now I believe that moment was indeed what the experts refer to as the final rally. I felt like Mike's body was just dying, not dying of Parkinson's or anything else. His body had contained him. Now it was worn out, and he was preparing to leave it behind. So I felt free to talk to him about the process. I did vacillate, though, between acceptance of him dying and wanting to go back to us 15 months ago before he told me he knew he was dying. Together, Greta and I dressed him in a t-shirt from Montana State University where he got his first master's degree. After lighting a candle on the windowsill, we rubbed his cold feet with sanctifying frankincense, massaged his legs, and kept a vigil, paying attention to changes in his breathing. After a few minutes, Greta went to the living room to knit by the fire. Pretty soon, Mike's breathing entered the fish-out-of-water stage. It is the final stage of breathing, which could last a few minutes or a few hours. His mouth was open and his tongue came out to gather more air, just like the book said. I went in to get Greta. "Shall we sing something?" she asked, picking up her iPod. We sang Hallelujah along with Katie Lang. Mike had heard me singing pieces of that song 1,000 times and he was tired of it. One line always struck a chord, though, so like our lives for the last few months. The minor fall, the major lift. Maybe he was tired of hearing it, but he loved Katie Lang, and this was different from all the other times he'd heard me singing. It was three women singing. Then we stood quietly for a few more minutes, simply paying attention to every breath. I don't know what Greta was thinking about, but I do know that she was getting her story. As I stood over what really is my husband's deathbed, it occurred to me that I wouldn't like being patted a lot when I'm dying. That would make me nervous and anxious, but I would like the feel of someone's hand gently, softly entwined in mine or resting on the side of my head. So that's what I did for Mike. Greta and I had been standing there in silence for a few minutes when she whispered, "Do you feel like church?" Neither of us go to church on a regular basis, but she was right. There was something missing, a hole that needed to be filled immediately, and ideally by a professional. "I guess I do," I told her, "but I don't know how to get in touch with our chaplain. I don't have her phone number, and I'd have to go through hospice. We might not have time for that." As an afterthought, I said, "It's too bad the woman up top is not around. Angela, my neighbor, is a chaplain with a different hospice, though. She and her husband are in Brazil for another year." I was flummoxed. What could I do? "The woman brought a bouquet of flowers yesterday," Greta said. "She said she lived right up there. Her number's in the basket on the counter." I retrieved the number, and it was my neighbor. It was 8:35 a.m. when I called and explained that I thought Mike was close to dying and asked if she would come down and say a prayer. Was I really saying what I just said? "This is for real. I'll be right down." Within 5 minutes, Angela was at our door. Seeing her rush through the entryway, I thought again about the synchronicity and good fortune of living in this neighborhood. I thought it was appropriate that Angela was dressed in a white shirt slathered with red and pink hearts. Of course, because this is an occasion of love. No time for introductions, Angela went immediately to Mike. With Greta and me flanking the bed, she talked to Mike calmly, lovingly, as if it was any ordinary day on the lane. Gently stroking his hand, she introduced herself. Angela's message was one of peace and joy. She told Mike he was safe where he was going. She said assuringly, "There are people waiting with their arms open wide, waiting to greet you, Mike." It was a blessing that lasted about 5 minutes. When Angela was finished, she placed her hand on Mike's chest and said, "Now you can go, Mike." Whoa. I felt a sharp pang in my chest, forcing me to take a quick pinched breath. While I recalled dramatic stories of people who were told they could go now, and then they did. Could there be another rally? I wondered if we'd said everything we wanted to say. What more is there besides thank you? Hardly breathing, I held Mike's hand. His face softened and his eyes remained open just a slit. He took two more laborious fish out of water breaths. His head shifted gently to the right and he exhaled one more time. Then he went still. It was 8:55 a.m. At that moment, I felt as close to God and eternity as I could ever be. Mike's eyes were on the yellow bird sculpture at the end of his bed near the window, and I felt a space opening around his bed. It was like a bright yellow halo sweeping across the wood floor, slowly expanding until it encircled the whole room, as if his death created a holy space, proof that we live for something bigger than ourselves. In the face of that miracle, the surrounding activities of life suddenly became miniaturized. While inside the space, love and opportunity rose up with open arms and open hearts to greet us. For me, it was visible and visceral. I saw the space open, washing across the floor, inviting me to remember the profound event I had witnessed and the importance of every moment getting there. I recovered my own breathing long enough to ask Angela, "How often does that happen, that a person dies moments after you give them permission to go?" She acknowledged it was rare, but she said, "I think Mike was prepared and ready to go." Some people call that kind of death that spiritual thing that happens at the end of life. And others believe if a person wants to and has a chance to complete their end-of-life work, share memories, and say goodbye, they will have an easier time of letting go. In psychology, a moment like this is known as a peak experience. I'll say, anybody, including me, might think that the way Mike died was too perfect to be real, but that is exactly how it happened. In a way, it was because of Parkinson's that his death could be natural and drug-free, because he didn't suffer any pain due to Parkinson's. I didn't realize that I was still in my somewhat ragged pajamas when Angela gave me a hug and headed for the front door. I thanked her for being there and complimented her on choosing that particular shirt to wear on this occasion. She smiled. "Well, it is Valentine's Day." How could I have missed that? How could I? At that moment, it occurred to me that Mike was in control of how and when he died. Norman Fisher has something to say about an experience like this. He says in his book, Taking Our Places, and I did get permission to use this paragraph in my book, "When you have lived long enough to find a way of being that suits you, you do become calmer and more stable. When you've learned how to be confident enough to give yourself willingly and completely to what's in front of you, life holds you in place, for you are not off balance. Nothing is out of place. Grabbing for something other than what arises in front of you, you are willing to stand where you are, looking straight ahead without glancing off in a million directions. Some might call this strength of character, but to me it seems more like inspiration. We are inspired by what happens, and what happens deepens us. Life becomes more interesting. Rather than feeling that we have to seek a new or exotic experience, we become fascinated with whatever our situation happens to be. We love wherever we are. We love whatever our life provides. Living just as it is enough for us. There's tremendous steadiness and reliability in this acceptance, whatever our personal style of expressing it may be." So Lately, I've been thinking about Mike's last breath and that intense halo of light that rushed across the floor, encircling the room. Could there be a connection to Tim's talk about inner gold and the transfer of that gold to another person? My question was, what happens if you transfer all your inner gold to another person and then that person dies? Could it be that the gold was transferred that day and I didn't recognize it? And one more question. After impermanence and letting go, what then? The answer is, love is.